American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Hello, campus cronies. Welcome back to Campus Crime Chronicles. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Turner, higher education professional and true crime addict. In every episode of this podcast, I take a deep dive into some sort of true crime that occurred on a school campus or a crime that's associated with a college or university in some way. For each episode, I rate the seriousness of the crime from 1 to 5 on my serious crime scale, with 1 being completely not serious, possibly even a little humorous from time to time, to 5 being very serious. This episode is rated a 5. When 22-year-old college student Jenna Burley didn't show up to classes during the first week of school and wasn't responding to texts or calls, her father quickly became worried and reported her missing. Unfortunately, Jenna's body was found a few days later, over 100 miles away. An intense yet swift investigation led police right to her body and her killer. This episode is titled A Chance Encounter. So without further ado, let's get started. August of 2017, Jenna Burley had just embarked on her first week of classes at Temple University, a public four-year research institution in Philadelphia. She was a junior transfer student from Montgomery County Community College, where she had previously received her associate's degree in liberal arts. At Temple, Jenna was studying film and media arts, and she aspired to one day become a filmmaker and change the world. Everyone who knew Jenna described her as quote-unquote unapologetically herself, definitely a young woman who many others admired and respected. Born on November 4th, 1994, a very special date because November 4th is my birthday as well, but Jenna Nicole Burley grew up in a traditional family household with her parents, Ed and Jacqueline Burley, and her siblings, sister Janelle, and brothers, Jeb and Jacob. While attending college, Jenna lived at home with her parents in Harleysville, Pennsylvania, which is only about 30 miles from Temple. On Wednesday, August 30th, 2017, Jenna was only a few days into her first semester at Temple. That night, she met her dad, Ed, for dinner, and afterward, she told him that she was planning to go out with a group of friends to celebrate and kick off the new school year. So she asked him to drop her off at a friend's house in the Temple area, which is where she planned to stay for the night after going out. The next day, though, on Thursday, August 31st, Ed had not heard from his daughter, which was very, very unusual. She was not responding to texts or calls, so Ed, with his concerned fatherly instincts kicking in, drove to the university and discovered that she had not gone to classes that day either. And that, especially, was not like his daughter at all, which means he immediately knew that something was wrong, so he quickly reported her missing to Temple University police. 2 days later, on Saturday, September 2nd, 2017, Ed posted to his Facebook account that his daughter had passed away. The post read, quote, "Our beautiful angel Jenna is now in heaven. Now I know for sure that you can have a broken heart. R.I.P., honey," end quote. So what happened in those few hours after Ed dropped his daughter off at her friend's house and the next day when she didn't go to class? Obviously, it was a tragedy involving her parents' worst nightmare. So let's go through the timeline. After Ed reported Jenna missing, both Temple University police and Philadelphia police got to work and hit the ground running the same day. Investigators first learned the name of the bar that Jenna and her friends had gone to the night before. According to the reporting of Julie Shaw for the Philadelphia Daily News, the friends hung out at Pub Web, a local bar in the Temple area, located at 1527 Cecil B. Moore Avenue. There, Jenna's friends called it a night before the bar closed, but Jenna stuck around until closing time because she had met 29-year-old Joshua Hooperterse, a former Temple student who lived in the area. According to investigators, Jenna and Hooperterse did not know each other before meeting at the pub that night, but the two had drank heavily and hit it off. So, investigators turned to security footage from the bar for answers and to try to establish a timeline of Jenna's movements. They were quickly able to determine that Jenna and Hooperterse left at around 2 a.m. From there, they were seen walking toward his apartment, which was located just down the street in the 1700 block of Cecil B. Moore Avenue. So investigators reached out to Joshua, hoping he could provide them with some answers. I mean, it was looking like he was quite possibly the last person to see or interact with Jenna before she went missing. Amy B. Wong for the Washington Post reported that when police contacted Hooperterse, he claimed he had been too intoxicated after leaving the bar to recall who he was with. So he said he was so drunk that he couldn't even remember who he left with. But investigators didn't just take his word for it, and they had a hunch he knew more than he was letting on. So next, they reached out to Hooperterse's roommate, a guy named Jack Miley. Unlike Hooperterse, Miley provided investigators with a lot more details from the night of August 30th and into the next morning of August 31st. For starters, he said both he and Hooperterse had planned to go out that night, but beforehand, he took a Xanax and had a few beers to pregame. He said they went to one other bar before they ended up at Pub Web. Miley said that he had been drinking pretty heavily all night, which included multiple beers and shots of liquor. Plus, he had been under the influence of both the Xanax and marijuana. So, he said, he called it a night and left the bar before Hooperterse did. He told police that he went home, quote-unquote, very drunk, very intoxicated. Julie Shaw reported for the Philadelphia Inquirer that a residential surveillance camera confirmed that Miley returned to the apartment before Jenna and Hooperterse at around 1 a.m. on the morning of August 31st. Miley told police that when he got back to the apartment, he went straight to his bedroom and fell asleep with a fan on high next to his bed. But Miley also told them some critical information that prompted investigators to quickly secure a search warrant for their apartment. He told them that he didn't wake up until around 1 p.m. on Thursday, August 31st, which he said was typical for him after a night of heavy drinking. But when he did wake up, he found Hooperterse cleaning up what appeared to be blood from the kitchen counter and floor. And he noticed that Hooperterse had a big cut on his hand and scratches on his neck. When Miley asked him about it, though, he simply said he had woken up in a pricker bush. Okay. Anyway, after executing the search warrant for the apartment, investigators discovered some evidence that led them right back to Joshua Hooperterse. They found blood in the sink, as well as on a door and on the lid of a trash can. In addition to that, they interestingly found $20,000 in cash and a substantial amount of marijuana that belonged to Hooperterse. Now, they just needed to find him wherever he was. I mean, he was at home, and by now, they were pretty sure something bad had happened to Jenna, and he was their number one suspect. By tracing his cell phone movements, police were led to a lakefront property owned by his grandmother in Pawpack Township, about 140 miles north of Philadelphia in Wayne County. According to an article in the Washington Post, police arrested Joshua Hooperterse on Friday, September 1st, 2017, and he was held without bail. Then, after searching the property extensively, they discovered Jenna's body the next day on Saturday, September 2nd, in a utility shed. That evening, law enforcement held a press conference announcing the arrest just 2 days after Jenna was reported missing. Now, what exactly happened inside Hooperterse's residence wouldn't be revealed until trial. But based on his charges, one can only assume that it was incredibly tragic and brutal. According to the reporting of Emily Scott for WHYY, Philadelphia's public media source, he was charged with murder, abuse of corpse, tampering with evidence, as well as possession of an instrument of crime. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported that, additionally, he faced a separate set of drug-related counts for what police described as a large amount of marijuana that was found at his apartment as well. And shortly after this, an autopsy revealed that Jenna's cause of death was the combination of strangulation and blunt force trauma. It was officially ruled a homicide. To the charges, though, Huppertreuss pleaded not guilty. CBS News reported that Captain John Ryan with the Philadelphia Homicide Unit said at the press conference that Jenna's murder did not appear to be premeditated. He also said that Huppertreuss had confessed to, quote, elements of the crime, end quote. As I previously said, though, specific details wouldn't be revealed until the trial, but let me give you a rundown of the information known at the time in the weeks and months following the murder. According to WHYY, investigators believe that Huppertreuss killed Jenna in his North Philadelphia apartment. He then placed her lifeless, naked body into a blue plastic storage bin, and later that day, on August 31st, he had his cousin drive him and the bin to his mother's house in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania. There, he stored the bin in a detached garage. Afterward, his cousin drove him back to his apartment in Philadelphia. And then the next day, on September 1st, Huppertreuss ordered a rideshare, more specifically a Lyft, which he took from his apartment back to his mother's house to retrieve the bin and body, and then he proceeded to have the Lyft take him over 100 miles north to his grandmother's property in Wayne County. Yes, you heard all of that right. A freaking Lyft took him and a body across the state of Pennsylvania. And just to answer the question that I'm sure all of you are thinking right now after you picked your jaws up off the floor, no, neither his cousin nor the Lyft driver ever knew what was inside the plastic bin. And never in a million years did it cross their minds that it was a body of a woman he killed. Julie Shaw reported for the Philadelphia Daily News that both his cousin and the Lyft driver later testified at a pretrial motion hearing in December 2018. At the hearing, they both said that they had no idea a body was inside. Talk about truth being stranger than fiction, huh? Anyway, moving on with our timeline. After his arrest, police obviously swabbed him for DNA and waited. You see, they had found a male DNA profile under Jenna's fingernails. And considering those scratches he had on his neck, yeah, they were pretty sure the DNA would be a match to Huppertreuss. But that's not all. Investigators also began putting more pieces of the puzzle together as they formed their case. You see, on the night of Jenna's murder, a Temple graduate student who lived directly above Huppertreuss's and Miley's apartment called police two different times to report some odd, unsettling disturbances. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported that the student, Noelle Sterling, first called Temple University police at around 2:15 a.m. on August 31st. She had heard footsteps in the gravel backyard of her building, as well as a series of banging noises. This was out of the ordinary for the area and what she would normally hear, so Sterling became afraid and called police. Within 5 minutes, two officers arrived. They entered her apartment, looked out her blinds, and spoke amongst each other before they told her they'd check out the backyard. However, Sterling said she never actually saw them go out there, which was only accessible via Huppertreuss's apartment, which was on the bottom floor. After this, Sterling, still uneasy and unable to sleep, called her mom to help ease her fears. During their hour-long conversation, though, Sterling heard additional noises that only intensified her fears. She recalled hearing banging noises that sounded, quote, almost like someone building furniture, end quote. Then, at around 4 a.m., Sterling heard a woman screaming. She said the blood-curdling scream lasted for nearly 3 whole minutes before it suddenly stopped. Sterling said, quote, no words, just screams. It sounded terrifying, almost like you were in a horror movie and a girl screamed, but it was worse, end quote. Upon hearing the screaming, Sterling immediately called Temple police once again. She was actually on the phone with the dispatcher when the screaming abruptly stopped. This time, police arrived within only a couple minutes, but Sterling told them she wasn't exactly sure where the screaming was coming from. She said the screaming was so unsettling that she couldn't focus on where it was and that it could have even originated from the building next door. She said, quote, all I knew for certain, it wasn't coming from the backyard, end quote. But despite not knowing where the scream originated, Sterling noted that she did not see the officers knock on any doors in the 3-story building she lived in. And the way Temple police responded actually caused some public controversy. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, their response differed from a Philadelphia police policy that was enacted over a decade prior in 2005. The policy regarding domestic violence calls requires officers to remain on the scene and call for a supervisor if the call involves reports of someone screaming. The supervisor, who must be a rank of lieutenant or higher, is required to respond, and that person, the supervisor, will then decide whether the circumstances demand officers to try to gain forcible entry into a private residence without a warrant. Apparently, though, an internal review of the situation determined that the responding university officers acted appropriately. A Temple spokesperson wrote in an email saying, quote, "The actions of the responding officers have been reviewed internally, and it has been determined that they acted in accordance with accepted police practice," end quote. And just to be clear, I'm not trying to bash Temple at all, not in the least. In fact, the university responded to Jenna's murder with caring and open communication. Both administration and student organizations made it a point to shed light on just how special and unique Jenna was. For starters, president of Temple University, Richard Engler, sent out a university-wide email informing the campus community of Jenna's untimely death. The email read in part, quote, "This is a tragic event, and anyone in the Temple community could be deeply touched by it," end quote. The email additionally informed students that counseling services were available through the on-campus clinic, and after regular business hours, psychiatric emergency services were available 24/7 at Temple University Hospital, Episcopal Campus in Kensington. There were multiple vigils held on campus as well, where several students left notes for their fellow classmate. During one vigil, which was jointly organized by the Student Government Association and the Temple University chapter of the NAACP, nearly 200 students gathered to mourn and say their goodbyes to Jenna. The Reverend Sean Mahoney spoke first, saying, quote, "She wanted to make a difference, and she was just beginning," end quote. President Engler also attended and spoke to the students. He said, quote, "I have heard that Jenna Burley was a remarkable woman with a strong commitment to helping others, especially the most vulnerable of society," end quote. According to a statement released by the Student Government Association, Jenna was described as, quote, "big-hearted, hilarious, fiercely feminist, unapologetically herself, and an incredibly woke young woman," end quote. You see, Jenna spent a lot of her time advocating for social justice and equality. She openly combated racism and sexism, and she regularly defended rights for the LGBTQIA+ community. On the night of Jenna's murder, the last t-shirt she ever wore had the words "positive vibes only" written across it. By all accounts, her friends said that was the very essence of Jenna and her spirit. She was truly a positive, outgoing, uplifting young woman who strived to make a real difference in her community. She wasn't afraid to be herself and express her personality. According to an article in The Morning Call by Laura McChrystal, Jenna often wore headbands with cat ears, bright pink jackets, and sunglasses shaped like hearts. She was a lover of poetry, literature, and film. One of her friends, Shauna Dugan, said, quote, "I think we all became much better people for knowing her," end quote. Shauna explained that whenever Jenna heard someone saying something mean or judgmental about someone else, Jenna would jump in to correct them. Shauna said, quote, "She'd say, that's not right. Accept them. Be nice. Every time I said something, I'd hear her in the back of my head," end quote. In March of 2017, before her death, Jenna had attended a women's march in Philadelphia, and later in June, she went to the Pride Parade in support of LGBTQIA+ rights. She also posted on a personal blog regularly about her beliefs and advocacy work. Her last blog post read, quote, "I will always fight for equality for all, and my journey is just getting started," end quote. Now, as news traveled around the campus and community about Jenna's murder and the person arrested for it, more information came to light about Joshua Hooperturse as well, particularly based on accounts of those who knew him or had interacted with him. His former neighbor, Natalie Abulhawa, said she got chills when she heard he had been arrested for the murder. She recalled that he would repeatedly ask her to hang out or smoke pot with him. One night in February of 2017, she almost took him up on his offer to hang out, not smoke, but something inside her made her change her mind. She said, quote, "I kept saying no, and usually people get it, but it continued throughout the whole year," end quote. Natalie also said he frequently lied to her. He told her he was in his early 20s, but the dude was really 29. And after he found out that Natalie played soccer, he told her that he, too, played for Temple on the men's soccer team. But that was a blatant lie as well. He was never listed as a player on the soccer team roster. Natalie said, quote, "Every encounter, I kind of had a bad feeling. I was never scared of him, but it was always something inside of me saying, probably don't hang out with this guy," end quote. Other people said he would often identify himself as Cali rather than provide people with his real name. A bartender who worked at Pub Web, a woman named Eleni, who did not wish to reveal her last name, said she knew Hooper Terse because he was a frequent patron of the bar. When he introduced himself to her, he said his name was Cali because he had lived in California. He also told her that he had a brother who was shot in Compton. Eleni said, quote, "There was something so weird about him. He was always saying he had so much money," end quote. She further said that he would send her pictures of cash and bundles of marijuana. But just FYI, according to Julie Shaw's reporting for the Philadelphia Daily News, there are no addresses listed in California for him or his parents. So a dude was not from California. That too was a big fat lie. However, according to that same article in the Philadelphia Daily, Hooper Terse's father, Octavio Hooper Terse, was shot in 1993 when he was only 32 years old. But it was in Pennsylvania, not in California. Octavio, a Mexican immigrant, was found dead in Springfield Township, a town in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. He was wrapped up in a trash bag with his hands tied after being shot in the back of the head. According to Shaw's reporting, nobody has ever been arrested for Octavio Hooper Terse's murder, and the case remains open to this day. Anyway, moving on, as Joshua Hooper Terse's trial approached, the prosecution offered him a plea deal in December 2018. He could plead guilty to third-degree murder and then be sentenced to a minimum of 30 and maximum of 60 years in state prison. But Hooper Terse struck it down. He told Common Pleas Court Judge Glenn Bronson that he wanted to move forward with a jury trial. So a trial was scheduled for January 7th, 2019. At the trial, prosecutors revealed critical details of how they theorized the night played out. They contended that Hooper Terse and Jenna had consensual sex inside the apartment, but that it turned to non-consensual when he tried to have anal sex with her. Prosecutors argued that her refusal triggered a violent reaction from Hooper Terse, which escalated into a fight. He then began beating her, so she grabbed a kitchen knife in an effort to defend herself, but he snatched it away from her and stabbed her. Prosecutors said he continued to pummel her before he strangled her on the kitchen floor. And not to be too graphic, but a medical report indicated that she had been punched about 38 times, she was hit on the head with a heavy object, likely a cereal bowl, she was stabbed repeatedly with a knife, and then she was strangled and killed. Investigators believed that she was likely killed at around 4 a.m., exactly when the upstairs neighbor heard the screams and called police. Now, at trial, Jack Miley, the roommate, was a critical witness for both sides, both the prosecution and defense. You see, Hooper Terse pleaded guilty to the charges related to transferring her body, but not guilty to the actual murder. Instead, he claimed it was actually his roommate, Miley, who killed Jenna. To be clear, though, this was just the defense's strategy. Miley was never implicated or charged with a crime, and police didn't share the same theory. But, according to the defense, they claimed Miley intervened in the kitchen fight, and in an effort to quiet her screaming, he killed her. The prosecution wasn't buying this version of events in the least. When Miley took the stand, he told them everything he had already shared with police, that he came home earlier than Hooper Terse, and that he was very intoxicated. He said he went to his bedroom and fell asleep with his fan on high and didn't wake up until hours later in the afternoon. He also said that he was a very deep sleeper, regardless if he had been drinking or not, but whenever he drinks, he becomes an even deeper sleeper. So he basically just slept through everything that was happening. Oh, and remember the cuts on Hooper Terse's hand and scratches on his neck that Miley had observed and asked him about? If you'll recall, Hooper Terse told Miley that he had woken up after his drunken stupor in a pricker bush. But when Miley brought it up again the next day, Hooper Terse had changed his story and told him he got cut from a broken cereal bowl. In closing arguments, Assistant District Attorney Jason Grinnell addressed the jury. He said, quote, "She was there, naked, lying on the ground. The last thing this 22-year-old girl would see ingrained in her mind was his face," end quote. Then, when he heard Jenna screaming for her life, he made a choice. Grinnell said, quote, "Those screams only said one thing. Josh, stop. Please stop. All he had to do was let go," end quote. But instead, he choked the life out of her and tried to pin it on his own roommate. Grinnell went on to tell the jury that DNA evidence pointed to Josh Hooper Terse and only Josh Hooper Terse. Then Grinnell pointed to Miley and said, quote, "You're excluded, Mr. Miley, and I'm sorry you had to sit through this," end quote. So yeah, remember the DNA under Jenna's fingernails? It definitely did come back as a match to Hooper Terse. And Grinnell asserted that her fingernails revealed her killer because she scratched his neck when he choked her. Grinnell said, quote, "Mr. Miley is excluded from that DNA. It's not Miley. Who did she scrape? Who did she claw? Who was the one holding her down? It's him," end quote. And then Grinnell pointed directly at Hooper Terse. After only 80 minutes of deliberation, the jury of 7 men and 5 women came back with a guilty verdict. He was convicted of first-degree murder and the other related crimes. As the verdict was announced, Hooper Terse showed no reaction, even though he would receive the mandatory sentence of life in prison. While sentencing him to life without parole, plus another 4.5 to 9 years for the other charges, Judge Glenn Bronson addressed Hooper Terse. He said, quote, "This was such an outrageous, depraved crime. You just extinguished the life of a very special person who had a lot to give," end quote. Then, clutching her rosary beads, Jenna's mother, Jacqueline, offered a victim impact statement. She said, quote, "Jenna was a loving, caring, compassionate, sassy, passionate person who was unapologetically herself. All she wanted was peace in this world," end quote. Jenna's father, Ed, added, quote, "She was my sunshine. She had a beautiful soul inside and out," end quote. Currently, Josh Hooper Terse, now 35 years old, is serving his life sentence at the Forest State Correctional Institution in Pennsylvania. Before I officially wrap up, I want to share something special about Jenna with you. By now, you've probably picked up on just how passionate and driven she was and how much she truly advocated for others and wanted to make a difference in the world. Before she died, she went around asking people to help donate backpacks for school children and unhoused people. One time, her car was filled to the brim with donated backpacks and supplies. And I think her friend Caitlin Duddy described it best when she said, quote, "She actually went out and did something about it. The rest of us are just talk," end quote. But now, even in her absence, Jenna's memory lives on and she continues to help others through a charity started by her parents, which is called Jenna's Blessing Bags. The nonprofit organization collects backpacks and fills them with items to give to people experiencing homelessness, including food, clothing, blankets, toiletries, and other personal hygiene supplies. According to the organization's website, Jenna's Blessing Bags strives to improve the current and future quality of life for unhoused individuals. For more information about Jenna's Blessing Bags or to make a donation, visit www.jennasblessingbags.org. That's JennasBlessingBags.org. Okay, y'all, that officially brings us to the end of Chronicle 73. As always, be sure to check out my social media where I post photos associated with each case and episode. You can find me at Campus Crime Chronicles on both Facebook and Instagram. Also, y'all, I still need reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and can leave a review. I promise. The more reviews I get, the more I'm bumped up in the algorithm or whatever it is, and the more people actually know that this podcast exists. And I'm still sticking to my word of dropping a bonus episode for every 100 reviews I get on Apple Podcasts. So I challenge all of you who haven't left one yet to keep them coming. And I'm really just singling out Apple because the majority of my listeners do listen on Apple. So if you don't follow the show on Apple, if that is where you listen at, be sure to click that little check mark at the top of the screen. That way the episodes will download to your feed automatically and you'll never miss anything released by Campus Crime Chronicles, especially now that I'm a weekly show and I'm publishing more. So review and follow. Those are your two tasks for the week. Okay, well, that's all for today, so bye for now. Campus Crime Chronicles is researched, written, and recorded by me, Nicole Turner, and it's edited and produced by Giari Gassaway. Tune in again in 1 week for the next Chronicle. Thank you.